Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of On Point. I'm Don Allen with my co-host over in Studio A, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you today?
Hi, Mr. Allen. How are you doing, sir? A nice day here in the Twin Cities. What temperature? Right around in, maybe say the mid-60s, if you will. Up and down weather. You know, we had temperatures as high as 103 degrees
earlier
in the week. We had two consecutive days of those temperatures, and then the temperature plunged by almost 40 degrees. In fact, it's looking at the Weather Service radar. It's 64 degrees here in the metro area. Interesting spring, if you will. What do we have, Mr. Allen? What's going on?
So there's a lot going on. We've been continually going to the meetings regarding the North Minneapolis tornado relief effort, and the players and the people put in sync to make sure that the community gets what they're supposed to get. But you know, this week also, Mr. Edwards, in the Star and Tribune, the Wednesday issue, June 8th, we have an article to come out, a copywritten story by Randy First, veteran reporter. City gives bad repair advice, where it talked of 22 unlicensed contractors that were on this list. And it was very interesting to see that. And
the mystery list that we first talked about and broke that story here on Point about 12 days ago?
Yes, this is the list.
About 6 days, 7 days before the Star Tribune. Okay.
Exactly.
It's the same list, the mystery list.
The mystery list. The mystery list that we don't know how they got on there. Well, it comes to find out, Mr. Edwards, we'll probably get into that in a minute or two here. We have some insight on how that list was developed, where the origin of that list came from, and the players involved right after the storm and then the following morning. With that said, there were some pretty interesting events and turn of events that have happened around the table with the people at the table. And it's going to prove to be pretty interesting if they can get it together, if a plan can be made. Because, you know, on yesterday, Mr. Edwards, I was at the tornado relief meeting, as were you. And I asked, you know, when do we get to see the plan? Is there a plan?
Correct.
Go ahead.
And it should be, because the Minneapolis Foundation's website, as of this very hour, is carrying information which indicates about $1,086,000 is on the table. And, you know, for 3 weeks, ever since around, the 29th of May, when the real first committee, the official formal committee meeting took place, of the recovery group, we never could get a figure. I mean, we knew some figures were being thrown around. This past Monday, if I'm not mistaken, a high-ranking official of the Minneapolis Foundation indicated $750,000 in play, right?
Yes.
On the table, and now the website is indicating $1,083,000. But it does say, as of course is the application that has been certified by the federal government for FEMA monies, is that nothing will go to individuals or SBA, small business operations, but will all go back to the state. I mean, excuse me, the city in this particular case. Now, in this morning's edition, again, of the Star Tribune, following up again on the investigative story by Randy First, the mayor has sent a communique to President Barack Obama concurring with Governor Mark Dayton's request, which led to a declaration. Of course, you did an exclusive interview a week ago with Senator Al Franken, right?
Yes, it
is. In
did.
Which Senator Franken first broke the information. 16.9 was what was going to be at play after, of course, we heard figures coming out of the 25th of May as high as $166 million. And, of course, in the previous two programs here at On Point, we kind of questioned the authenticity and accurateness of that, but then, you know, we were basically told we didn't know what we were talking about. Then 16-9 is what's at play. The mayor, by the way, the mayor will be meeting with the recovery group on Monday at 2 o'clock at OIC. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, sir.
Yes. Mayor R. T. Ryback, and then there are some other pieces which we will be floating into during the course of this program. But right now, it's, you know, it appears to be about the money, if you will. Now, here's something troubles me, Don, is that earlier in the week, on Monday of this week, a couple of the TV stations showed interviews with citizens that were going to be evicted this week, because this is a big weekend. The weekend of the 12th is a big weekend with respect to folks who have been evicted, right?
Yes. Yes.
And we kind of were told there wasn't a lot of discussion we could have about that, that it wasn't appropriate, kind of disingenuous for the black bloggers to raise those questions. I don't know why, but so anyways, this today is kind of force moving day, right?
It is force moving day.
Right. And I'm just kind of wondering where those citizens of our beloved city will be expected to go.
Yeah, and I saw the news, Mr. Edwards, that they were, it was actually Channel 9 that, or excuse me, Channel 5 KSTP, that inspectors were knocking on doors, giving people over this weekend to get out if they felt their houses were not safe to stay in. And still we have not addressed any of that.
And again, Recovery Committee has basically been told that that's not for discussion purposes, though I, you know, totally disagree. And one's just trying to figure out where these families, a predominant number, of course, once again, of African Americans being thrown out of their homes. I mean, and we just can't get a fix. And, you know, in some respects, you know, the mayor will probably be a dollar short, oops, and a day late for his chit-chat with at least a group of individuals that are involved and concerned about what is happening and what the future holds and et cetera. The other thing is, a couple of questions posed yesterday near the end of the meeting of the Recovery Committee, meeting at OIC in special session, was about employment. And now this takes us back to your reflections and this and the story by Randy First of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. There's no plan for guaranteed employment, is it?
No, there is no.
For African Americans, I mean. White folks are working left and right. Okay.
Yes.
And the city will get a large return on reimbursement from the 2,000 volunteers. Oops. 90% white that were in community this past Sunday, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they will, exactly.
And we couldn't get a figure there. We couldn't get a confirmation on how much that will be. Were the volunteers being compensated via the city at minimum wage, or you know, was it $10 a head per hour, or what? Do we have any figures, Mr. Allen? Have you been able to find anything on the computer network?
No, I have not. It's very hard because, Mr. Edwards, as you know, and as I also addressed on yesterday's meeting, where's the internal report? Where is our report? You know, a week ago, Friday, we heard, or two Fridays ago, we heard that there was $90,000 paid out. And still, we don't have a direction or a compass, including a moral compass, to find out these answers and find out where the money went, who's getting paid. If it's the contractors, if it's for patching roofs, there has to be a report somewhere. Someone's reporting to someone, but yet it hasn't been made available to this ad hoc group that is concerned, some concerned about the renters and the poor and North Minneapolis in general. So that's,
well, that's absolutely correct, Mr. Allen, and again, looking at the date, the tornado took place on the 22nd day of May. around 2:30 or thereabouts, 3 o'clock. By the 23rd, there were discussions and plans for attacking the problem. I don't want to use the military terms. The first meeting of the recovery committee was the 27th, and then we had the holidays, and then the recovery committee met again on the 1st. So let me see. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Geez, we've had about 8 meetings, haven't we?
Yes, quite a few.
Yeah, we've had at least 8 meetings. I mean, official meetings. Not talking in terms of the meetings that were taking place in other sites and locations and et cetera. Now, I understand the Ministerial Alliance met with Mayor R.T. Ryback on Tuesday. That was reported by one of the members' leadership. There's no report back on that, though, other than there was a meeting with the mayor and the Ecumenical were positioning themselves. The other piece that we seem to be troubled by, even though we had a alleged middle manager from the county come in, we can't get our hands around the actual figures. Can we, Mr. Allen? Have we been able to do that? I mean, do we know how many people are homeless, how many people still don't have food or sustenance or et cetera, how many people are really out of their homes, how many people are living in their cars, how many people are living with relatives who obviously they're starting to get on each other's nerves.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there some reason why why are we having a trouble? I mean, during this period of high technology and advanced electronics and et cetera, we just can't seem to get a number. And we can't seem – is there some reason we're not being allowed to talk to FEMA?
Yeah, and see, Mr. Edwards, there's a couple of things going on here. You know, FEMA's coordinating officer – for this area is Paul J. Ricuti.
And
he has not been brought into the room. Secondly, you have the county representative, that's Hennepin County, which is a county here in Minnesota for our international and domestic listeners that don't know, to come in and talk to the group. And he comes up with a number of 5,000 families, okay? But I have to think a little bit deeper than that. I know that if it's a family is usually more than one. So if they're talking 5,000 families and say each of those families have 3 individuals, you're talking about 15,000 people.
Or so the 12,000 that Mark Stanglein talked about. That's the county commissioner, Mark Stanglein.
Yes, county commissioner Stanglein. And also, if you go back, you know, they don't know numbers, and that's really hard for me to believe when we just got done doing a census.
I know. And by the way, Commissioner Mark Stanglein made the statement and declaration of 12,000 on, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Allen, it was on Wednesday, the 1st of June. Is that correct? Is that our recollection?
Yes, you're correct.
And because the following meeting, which was the 3rd of June, we were being told that we would be able to see FEMA and the county. In fact, at one point, we were told that we would be meeting on the 6th or the 8th, whichever you preferred, with representatives from both the city, the county, and the state, and allegedly we'd have FEMA. Only the county's representative showed up, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So we got one
and
out of three.
I'm beginning to be troubled by one of the reasons that the city's representatives didn't show up, because they already knew that the eviction process was fully engaged, which was then being reported by major white television stations here, though these things had been discussed here on Black Blog Radio at least 10 days before or 10 days prior.
Absolutely. See, Mr. Edwards, here's my theory, and this is not a conspiracy theory. This is just about what's happening right now.
Yeah, don't be a Jekyll or Hyde.
No, I'm not going to be Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. Not this time. But you see here, this is a positioning piece because, well, actually, Mr. Edwards, we have a caller, and I think we should probably chime in.
Let's get to the caller. We want to hear from community. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling. On point. Who am I speaking with?
Hey, this is John calling from Manhattan, New York. How are you guys doing today?
John, I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Real good, John. Well, I just wanted to know, because I'm sort of an outsider on this whole situation. Can you just give me like a brief, breakdown of the situation? You guys have a great show going on. You guys are winners. Can you please just give me a breakdown of the situation?
Okay, John, are you the gentleman that created the Facebook page for the that they've been talking about in different news articles for the North Minneapolis? You're not?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to know. I just read an article earlier today online about some gentleman from the East Coast that created a Facebook page to support the North Minneapolis tornado relief. Well, I'm going to give you my version, and Mr. Edwards has to give you his version because he has the historical data that will bring you kind of up to speed. What has happened here, it's like divide and conquer. You have a group of community members that are going to these meetings every day at 2 o'clock to talk about what's happening, what's going on with the different aspects of tornado recovery. You have the Red Cross. You have Salvation Army. You have this group called the Urban Homeworks that are doing great work. But now they have to pass off this duty, their responsibility, back to the local nonprofits. Well, North Minneapolis is a blighted area, as deemed by HUD, the Federal Housing and Development Organization. And so we've had empowerment zone money go through there, foreclosure money go through. Well, not through there, but we've had those monies assigned to this area. But what has happened because of the high population, over 42% of African Americans in that community, this money has bypassed those that would need it the most, which created the highest foreclosure in the state, in the United States, is in North Minneapolis. Yes, okay? But anyway, yes. Getting back to the tornado recovery, what has happened is we have some, what I'd like to say, some divisive units going on. We have a meeting, at the Summit Academy at the Cookie Cart every day with a group of community members. That's the one that Mr. Edwards and I attend. Then the city has their meeting. That's the politician. And then you have some fringe groups having meetings. So from the nonprofit point of view, from me looking in as a business person, I do not run or work for a nonprofit. I run a business, but there's not been a plan put on the table. And as Mr. Edwards said earlier, you have the Minneapolis Foundation that has raised in excess of $1 million, but yet they, in this case, the community, does not have a plan. And if you question or ask, like Mr. Edwards and I asked about the contractor list, and, we don't need to see that. That's not a question to be discussed or asked about. And then we find out that there's 22 unlicensed contractors on that list. Who's check dotting the I's and crossing the T's? Mr. Edwards, I'm going to hand it to you.
Excuse me? Give John the chronology. First of all, the tornado went through on the 22nd day of May around 2:30. It, in fact, stayed on the ground for 60 city blocks. Much of the area that it went through is an older part of the city, so you had a lot of wooden houses, and so there was significant damage. The tornado then went across the Mississippi River into another county, Anoka County, and particularly the municipalities of Fridley and Blaine. Now, by the early morning of the 23rd, the mechanism was in play. Meetings were going on. Contractor lists were being developed, which led to a number of individual contractors who were not properly licensed and et cetera. The state
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I actually have a friend who's on the line. His name is actually Raymond, and he's calling about the issue. Can you just bring him on real quick to our group conversation? I really want to hear your point on this.
Okay. And he's the same area code as you, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Raymond, is this you?
Hello. Is this Minneapolis Bloggers?
Yes, this is On Point with Don
Allen.
What's
your question, Raymond?
Hey, what's going on, guys? How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great.
Real good. We're doing real good, Raymond. Let's do this. We were, in fact, giving you a chronology of what happened here, starting with the tornado on the ground on the 22nd. Yeah, here's the thing that may be some interest of you gentlemen. One of you say that you're in New York City. Is that on the 25th, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which is the largest paper here in the state of Minnesota,
Yeah.
Wrote a story.
Thank you.
Information fed to them by city officials that the damage was $166 million. You know, that's a nice chunk of change.
$166 million.
Yeah, that's what they were saying. You have to remember, within 3 hours after the tornado here, unfortunately, there was a series of tornadoes in a place called Joplin, Missouri.
Yeah,
I think the city officials here got real enthusiastic, thought that they could bring in a tremendous amount of money and take care of a lot of other projects that are almost in
all
default. But anyways, what finally happened on the Saturday, the 29th, the junior senator from Minnesota, Al Franken, confirmed that the amount that FEMA had certified was $16.9 million. Okay?
Million.
And that has to be applied to two separate counties, Hennepin County and Anoka County. Since that time, though, there has been an enormous undertaking by the city of Minneapolis in siting facilities, homes and buildings for condemnation. And what's happening this afternoon here in our beloved city is that a disproportionate number of African Americans are being evicted from their homes, abodes, and et cetera. So that's
The thing is with that, you have these ideals, a lot of people, you know, thinking about the corruption behind it. But, you know, could there possibly be some truth behind what the government
what
is
kind
trying
of truth,
to...
What kind of truth are you talking about? Could be behind it?
I'm just speaking more of in general sort of a sense. I just want to know your opinion in terms of, you know, what exactly do you mean by you dissecting the corruption? Just like a simple thesis.
Well, let me do it like this. When we talk about the employment aspect, where folks are talking in terms of as a part of the rebuilding and stimulus and et cetera, there's this great discussion about how the African-American community will be afforded a tremendous opportunity. The only problem is, John, there was a report commissioned by the city. It took 5 years to complete and $500,000 of taxpayers' monies. Issued in October of 2010, and unfortunately the report clearly indicated that African Americans in this city are at the bottom of the totem pole with respect to being awarded contracts and receiving employment, and when they do receive employment on city-managed contracts, they receive basically 40% less in compensation per hour than white counterparts, Hispanics, Asians, and even Native Americans. And so there is a precedent, if you will, and there's empirical documentation that clearly shows that that aspect is a bunch of BS. The other problem is that there's really no commercial black, quote-unquote, entrepreneurship here in the Twin Cities and particularly on the north side. So when you ask the question about maybe we're seeing too much conspiracy, we have to take the position that there's empirical documentation that supports our position, okay?
Okay.
Are they still with us, Don?
I think one of them hung up and the other one was a clown. Let me see who we got here. Go ahead. You're live on the air.
Hello.
Okay. Go ahead. You're live on the air on point. May I ask who's calling? Hello.
Oh, that's the same. That was the same piece we were getting last week, having some problem with trying to click some other people in. Let's move on because we're talking about serious business. Even from our friends in Midtown Manhattan. You know, I find some of these questions, though, I think it's good, though, Don, because it's good for aggressive blog radio to be able to draw some of these kinds of questions out.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a game that's being played here, and we are not two black bloggers who are just sitting here spending our Saturdays spinning our wheels. We keep telling people the empirical data, the research is in our possession, in our hands, right in front of us here in our respective studios. So this is not a game that is going on here in the Twin Cities, particularly in an enclave that professes to have great ideals of liberalism and et cetera. And I find it amazing, Mr. Allen, that when we bring up the question of the studies, three specific studies, one done by an international think tank in Washington, one done by the University of Minnesota, and one done by a very prestigious private research group in Austin, Texas, that we don't get any pushback, do we?
No pushback.
Yeah, we don't get any pushback. And so that's what kind of tells me that a lot of times when folks such as the two previous callers make their call that, you know, they think this is the Amos and Andy hour. This is not the Amos and Andy hour, buddy.
Yeah.
So what else would he have?
Well,
by the way, give out that number, because, you know, it was interesting. You hadn't given out the number, and these two individuals were able to get through to us. Wasn't that interesting?
Yeah, that was really interesting. We're broadcasting live from the McIntosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis. Our number is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. And, Mr. Edwards, I'd just like to, you know, interject where I left off before the callers called in. I'm talking about the divide and conquer. I kind of explained it to the guy, but I really didn't go into that much detail. We have a group led or fronted by Summit Academy OIC's president. Then we have a group of people at the table, and it's really challenging to figure out what the motivation is. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the group We Care. We Care is the group with the bogus contractors list on it. And
right.
you can see, you know, We Care popping up in black newspapers all across the Twin Cities. Well, actually, one black newspaper. And so you're questioning their intention. But as you said to the caller, Mr. Edwards, the number on the table was $166 million. Okay. Cockroaches
That's right.
came out of the woodwork. Okay.
Yes, they did.
Because if it was $166 million, City of Minneapolis could easily give four or five of the agent provocateurs $500,000 and not miss a beat. Okay? And
that's
so,
correct. And in fact, as we said on these programs, Black Blog Radio, two Saturdays ago, that the $166 million figure that the city was floating through its favorite newspaper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, was going to allow for a lot of things to be taken care of. And in this conversation with the previous callers, it was no accident when we said intentionally that this was going to be an opportunity to deal with some projects, public works projects, and et cetera, that were almost in default. And one of them was the Plymouth Avenue Bridge, which has become a serious embarrassment to the city of Minneapolis. It's a bridge that wasn't even 5 years old, and this is a city, by the way, where we have bridges fall in the water.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Major arterials like Highway 35 and et cetera. And so when it was discovered that the Plymouth Avenue Bridge had been poorly constructed and that corrosion and deterioration was already taking place, that bridge was immediately closed down last fall and will probably be closed for the next 2 years. Well, that was a cost incurrence that clearly the city hadn't planned for. And they'd been looking for quite some time for a way to, quote-unquote, augment the amount of money that was going to have to be paid to repair that bridge. And there's no way in the world that they were going to be able to come up with it unless there was government assistance, okay? And so that's something that folks need to talk about. Nobody talks about it, if you will. But I think that maybe the guys thought we made a mistake, but the $166 million, no, it wasn't made up by the black bloggers here on point. It was an article positioned in the Minneapolis Star Tribune on the 25th of May, and it talked in terms, wow, $166 million, Billy Bob, of damage in that North Minneapolis. Now, what has also happened, and we have talked about this, and we are writing about it, and et cetera, in our respective domains, is that this is all a part of gentrification.
Yes, exactly.
And some of that is taking place as we speak, where a significant number, we're not talking about, of course, mass numbers as if it was the Bataan Death March, but if you will, of the Philippines in the Second World War. But black people and poor whites are being put in the street as we speak.
Yep. And it's
okay,
it's,
they have received their notices. They were given basically 20 days to find somewhere else to go. We were talking with some people in Zone 1, which is the area just south of Olson Highway, okay, there in proximity to Glenwood. And African-American families down there looked up, and city inspectors showed up 2 weeks ago, did surveys, and then yesterday put the patches on the door. And people are being given down there, they're being given in Zone 1 to August the 1st to get out. others in the area of Zone 2, which is basically up around, let's say, 30th and Fremont down to Broadway and et cetera, have been given until today to get out. Nobody's talking about that.
No. No one's not even in
and no
the
no one wants to talk about it.
Yep, no one wants to say a word about what's going on. Again, you have, for those of our listening, international and domestic, if you go to KSTP Channel 5, there's a great video up there called Post-Tornado Home Inspection. Some North Minneapolis residents may be forced to move. And they actually follow an inspector up there and listen to telling a black family that they're going to have to leave their house. Dangerous. Keep out. Unlivable. And so very interesting.
And inspectors will be out again this week, according to city officials in the meeting yesterday at OIC, the Recovery Committee. Inspectors will be going out this time, allegedly they'll be taking mental health workers with them and others. And what they will be doing is that they will be checking again on the sites to determine if any persons are living there. If so, they are being informed that they must vacate.
Yep. And it's really not it's not a healthy atmosphere at all. But getting back to that group, this task force, or whatever you want to call that conglomerate or collaborative, it seems, Mr. Edwards, that, you know, decisions are being made, and what's going on in that group just really has nothing to do with what's going on outside of those doors from that group. I mean, you have the city moving full
speed
ahead.
Well, here's what I've been told last night, Mr. Allen, you're actually on point. It appears that there's friction now between Mr. King of OIC and his faction and Councilman Don Samuels and his wife, who heads up the Achievement Zone, Peace Foundation, some other entities, because the elected city councilman, and I assume probably the state legislator who hasn't been seen since around the 1st of June, that Mr. King and OIC and his associates have hijacked the process. Now, no one will explain what the process is, but that the process has been hijacked. And what this led to was yesterday a very kind of emotional overview by Mr. King about his affinity and respect for a community activist known as Alfred Flowers. Because Mr. King said yesterday at the meeting that he had been told, and now we are hearing that the sources that told him this were city officials, that Mr. Flowers was asking too many questions and causing too many problems, and that he needed to be jettisoned.
Yes.
Now, I'm not understanding what happened to the First Amendment. I mean, I know the First Amendment gets hijacked all the time, but I'm trying to figure out what happened to the First Amendment. And so there's friction. Now, we talk a lot about transparency. Am I correct?
You're correct.
And yet when we ask questions relevant to transparency, we are told that we, you know, particularly this Bob radio program, we're acting like Jekyll and Hyde, and we are Jekyll and Hyde. In fact, a fellow journalist yesterday, after you had left, actually took you to task. With respect to the fact that you were recording and doing a chronicle of what was happening, and I thought that, well, you know, if this person was worth their salt as a journalist, you should be commended, not criticized and stabbed in the back. But it was a fellow journalist of ours.
Yeah, that's just very interesting. Very interesting. And I admit, and I know I had a chance to contact this person and just give him a couple of choice words, Mr. Edwards, and since he's not a public figure, we're just going to, we don't want to give him no credence or anything, so we're just going to leave his name out there on the shelf. But I just kind of explained to him that, stay in his field of expertise was the exact
whatever
word.
Whatever that is.
Yeah, whatever
right,
you know? It could be a lot of things. Yeah. So,
if you would, you want to go back to the list, because, again, the two callers, for whatever reason, they called themselves doing what they did, particularly one talking about he. I don't know if they understand that we have very sophisticated equipment here in the studios, and we can actually decrypt some of your phone numbers. And so, you know, folks talking about they're calling from Midtown Manhattan. Okay, that's great. Then you asked them a specific question because my sense was that was the individual that you had read about.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the same John. But anyways, the list that came up. Now, I think it's time to just to go ahead and do what we have to do. We have found out, Mr. Allen specifically taking the leadership here, On Point and its affiliates, in fact, broke through and found out the date, time, place, and key principles that put together the list that turned out to be identified by the Star Tribune now, not by us, okay, though we clearly indicated that the list raised serious questions relevant to its legality, but that the meeting took place on the morning of the 23rd of May, within hours of the tornado, in the offices of an individual who runs a paper. And that present in that meeting at 8 o'clock that morning in Mr. McFarland's office were a number of heavy political figures, and at least one of them has clearly indicated that the list was developed there. It was then passed on to Velma Corvell, the director of the Civil Rights Department and keeper of contract compliance responsibility for the city of Minneapolis. The bogus list was then made up and was immediately distributed, if you will, and just a horde, if you will, of white contractors descended and already descended upon the community and were able to identify themselves as legitimate and bona fide. And not until the black bloggers working with the Star Tribune were able to break this in a expanded manner, expanded to the extent that we were able to embrace a large, large audience, was the illegality of the list exposed to the general public. Now,
yes,
we could not get any significant dialogue within the committees or the city or any place else about what should be the consequences of all the citizens, black and white, in North Minneapolis who were taken to the cleaners.
Uh-huh. No, they would not. It's just very strange. You know, you would think, I've been in several different circumstances, Mr. Edwards, where there are groups or meetings like that in corporate America. If there's a question asked, it's answered. But here they want to dodge, duck, and hide and misinform you or tell you that you're attacking people, and which is clearly not the case. We just want to be fully informed before we put our assets out on the limb. You know?
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And also, it's necessary because we addressed it last week, and we, in fact, asked for any calls, anyone to call, anyone to challenge. We know a whole lot of folks are listening. We see the numbers at the conclusion of each program, so we know that. We, last Saturday, indicated that just 2 days prior, we had attended a meeting of the minority contractors.
Yes.
Their annual meeting. In fact, their national president was present. Number one, my associate, Mr. Allen, was told that he could not take any pictures or record the meeting, which was kind of interesting. But in the course of and near the conclusion of the meeting, the issue of the list came up. And in fact, we reported this last week, the head of the Civil Rights Department's contract compliance unit, a Mr. Johnny Burns, was present and could not answer any questions relevant to the list. In fact, he maintained he didn't know where the list came from. Of course, 4 days later, Randy First, writing in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, gets confirmation, and then Mr. Allen gets confirmation that, number one, the list was bogus. Star Tribune asked the Department of Labor for the state of Minnesota to step in. They walk into a trailer up there on Penn and Broadway, and the list is right there. When the state of Minnesota asked for the group for to authenticate, and we care, if you will, that name of the group who no one seems to know, to authenticate how this list came about and et cetera, people went to telling stories until the Star Tribune confronted Velma Corvell and the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and went to Mike Christensen. By the way, Mr. Allen, keep in mind that Mr. Christensen has not been to the last four meetings.
No, he has not.
That's right. But Mr. Christensen, in the story, the copyrighted story in the Star Tribune this Wednesday, this past Wednesday, confirmed that the city had made an egregious error by allowing this list to be posted, and that citizens of our city, and particularly of our community, had in fact been taken advantage of by individuals who were not qualified under Minnesota law. This is not some law made up by the black bloggers. This is Minnesota law, made up by a predominantly white legislature. Okay? And so now there's confirmation that these lists were bogus, that people were taken to the cleaners, and yet there's been no offer by the city of Minneapolis to reimburse those citizens who were taken to the cleaners with shoddy work and performance. Okay? Nobody even talks about that.
Nope, they sure don't.
And that's how things, that's how things, be you in Manhattan, New York, or Bombay, India, that's how things work here. Okay, to raise the question to us about corruption. Corruption is the order of the day. This is little Chicago.
Yeah.
Okay? This is little Chicago. You know, and we all sit around and BS each other as if this is a quote-unquote Minnesota nice. It's Minnesota nice when you talk in terms of white folks being nice to white folks, but when you talk in terms of being considerate of the circumstances in which people of color have to live under, these folks turn and look the other way.
Yes, they sure do. They sure
do. That's the name of the game, baby. That's how it works here. Okay, give the number again. You know, for those that are peeking in and looking in, call in if you got any questions.
Yes, that number is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. We invite our listeners to give us a call, questions, topics, subject, whatever. Let's roll with it. Mr. Edwards, just not to change gears on this, but I just got a communique from our friends at Springboard, the Economic Development Corporation. And you talked along the lines just less than a minute ago about white folks being nice to white folks. And when it comes to people of color, it's kind of a whole different page here. Well, it's a story in an article, in the Star Tribune business section. It says, contractors, semicolon, MnDOT fails minority test. There was a meeting today with the National Association of Minority Contractors regarding Geiger Signal in South Minneapolis, and as MnDOT's disadvantaged business program is only doing like 5.6% of its goals, if that. And it also goes into detail. Yeah. And those numbers are fudged anyway. But again, you know, we have MnDOT $600 billion in 10 years, and less than 1% went to minority contractors. So, again,
and I remind Mr. Allen, I think it's important we do this. I remind our listening audience that a little less than a year ago, the chief executive of Springboard called in. He gave those figures. In fact, he was purged from MnDOT's oversight committee, advisory committee, because he began to raise questions, and he was purged from the committee. In fact, they called security personnel to stop him from going into the committee, and then he received a letter, if I'm not mistaken. We've had him on these programs a number of times last summer. He gave this warning. He laid out the facts. He laid out the information. And then later on at the end of 2010, we got absolute confirmation from a $500,000 study commissioned by the city of Minneapolis with Minneapolis taxpayers' monies, $500,000, which confirmed everything that was being said over these airwaves, and it had been said by us in our respective roles. And, you know, again, I mean, I've been sitting in these meetings. I've been listening to people talking about recovery and how well things are going to go for the black population and et cetera. Man, I know and understand. That's all a myth.
Yes, yes.
You're talking to the man that helped write the civil rights legislation of this city over 40 years ago.
Wow.
Let me just give us an example. We heard just a passing reference yesterday that finally folks are admitting, though Mike Christensen had to confirm that to him when we asked him a question back on the 1st of June, that African-Americans and others have a right of return, right, Mr. Allen?
Right, correct.
And yet the city has not conveyed materially, by material documentation, to those that had been displaced, that they have a right of return by law. It's a part of the civil rights ordinance of this city of Minneapolis that people who are displaced in situations such as this, natural disasters and et cetera, have a right of return, okay? We already know that African Americans are being referred to by city officials, architects, and others as immigrants and cockroaches and et cetera. By the way, the expression cockroach first emerged in the 1990s during the genocide in Rwanda and Burundi in East Africa. But when you lay these kinds of things out, people pretend like they don't understand what you're talking about.
Yep, I agree. I agree 100%. Mr. Edwards, it looks like Mr. Mustafa will be calling in here any moment based on our last week's conversation at the end of the show. So we'll wait for him to call here. And I have alarms going off everywhere here. So let me turn them off.
Oh, is that right? What's happening?
Studio B, we got some news coming in. And I'm just going to look at it right now. I kind of have these alerts set up. And I think this has something to do with the Republicans are elected officials in Washington, D.C., and while I'm in Studio B here pulling this up, and it's going to take a minute here, and we're just about there. Mr. Edwards, while we're waiting for Mustafa to call in. Yeah.
Okay, well, you know there's a lot of discussion going on about the attempt to force Representative Wiener to resign. He is now asked the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, Republican of Ohio, that he will be Representative Wiener will be taking a leave of absence to receive care, both medical and mental, with respect to his condition. And you know, I guess that's great. You know what I mean?
What condition did he have? I mean, that you text.
Well, you know, I guess he's somewhat misogynist, if you will.
Okay.
I use that word, but and you know, he, you know, apparently he likes to put himself or some parts of his anatomy on his website. You know what I mean?
Oh wow!
And send it to young ladies. And somewhere, in fact, it was the blogger who put out the false information on Shirley Sherrard a year ago. That actually busted him. And so anyways, that's something that's coming out of Washington as we speak.
Okay.
But the other big news has been the individual who had been suspected of masterminding the bombings over a decade ago in Kenya and Tanzania. He is called Al-Qaeda's chief strategist in Africa, if you will. He allegedly was killed in Somalia, if you will, I assume it was Somalian or it was African state military task force that has been operating in Somalia. I'm not quite sure. They're still trying to get all the facts together. So those are a couple things that are coming out of Washington with a lot of emphasis as pertains to the national news, if you will. But anyways, want to move back until if you have Mustafa or someone else calls in.
We have a caller now, Mr. Edwards.
Oh, let's get him. Okay. All right.
You're live on the air. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Mustafa.
Hey, Mustafa.
Yeah, okay, Mustafa. How you doing? What do you
I'm
got?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Real good.
Yeah,
I want to pick back up where you were talking about last week, what you were talking about with us.
Before I go into that, I would like to mention what I hear about that's related to the tornado. I heard some African-American guy who was in jail and who was serving his time and he was supposed to be released. They were releasing because his house was in that area, and you know the city said the house is inhabitable, and he has
uninhabitable, condemned. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it took his lawyer to you know complain and threaten lawsuit and things like that. Finally, after a couple of days, they let him out, and that's another. You know, version of how, you know, the people are using this disaster against the people, the victims of the disaster.
Yes, and as we talked about on last week's program, people are not understanding that once on the 23rd of May, the mayor asked for and received from the city council and concurrence from the state of Minnesota, declared that part of North Minneapolis a disaster area, and then imposed a curfew. Technically, what you've done is also indicated a state of emergency. And in this country, a state of emergency basically eliminates and invalidates writ of habeas corpus, if you will. And so it means you have no rights, if you will. Authorities can enter your home without warrant, if you will, unannounced, and et cetera. And so I'm not surprised what you told me, Mustafa, as one who understands how the laws of this country work, is that for an individual who had allegedly served his time or carried out whatever it was he needed to do, was all of a sudden told that he could not be released and could, because of circumstances in a community which was under a state of emergency. This is the right of government. It doesn't make it right, but it is the right of the government to do that. And we're seeing that with respect to how people are being dealt with. Last week, Mr. Allen and myself received calls last Sunday from people who, and these were whites, these were white citizens who were observing African-Americans being stopped, detained, and ordered off the streets and back into their homes because they didn't want them, quote-unquote, the authorities did not want them mingling with white volunteers. And so I can appreciate what you've just told us. This is part of a pattern in practice. But what else do you have, Masafa?
That sounds to me some kind of martial law to me. And I also have information related to the police officer in some who executed in Oakland who killed Oscar Grant. He will be released Monday, tomorrow after tomorrow.
Yes. Sir, basically no time at all. This is the BART officer if that Mustafa is talking about that shot and killed a young man on film, point blank.
Wow.
Yeah.
Know who we're talking about, Mustafa?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I saw that video, too. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, wow.
Shot him right in the back of the head. The officer pretended that he thought he was reaching for his taser, but pulled out his service revolver, which is interesting because you had a service revolver long before officers were ever issued these tasers. But hey, a judge basically found him guilty of manslaughter or something like that, and Mustafa, you're saying that he's being released, this officer's being released on tomorrow or Monday?
Yeah, somebody sent me an email about that. And,
mm-hmm.
I haven't said it, but it's something I expected to be true because of how things are. They didn't want to do anything, to begin with when he fled to some other state, Nevada, I think, after he committed this execution.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, and also.
Stop, let me ask you this question because it was part of what we're talking about. We're seeing a lot of coverage all of a sudden about suicide bombers, and we're seeing the ugly head of racism emerge and being pointed towards the Somali community here in the Twin Cities once again. Story in this morning's edition of the paper. Just how serious is the pressure being brought on the Somali community about the situation in Somalia, the suicide bombers, the young men? Just how, in your estimation, how serious is that right now at play?
It's quite serious, and, this has been going on for a while, and the media and, everybody, they put us as every Somalian is a terrorist, and that gives them, deny their right to Somalis or mistreat them, and so many things that they try to justify because somebody, allegedly did some crime in almost 10,000 miles from here, which that's how far Somalia is, even though many.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and I noticed that particularly Channel 9, I noticed, they couldn't even get the name right. In fact, they had two different individuals that there was allegedly the individual, and then they said that the individual that they were incorrect about must have been accompanying the individual who died at the scene, and that this individual, who they initially made a mistake about, probably had been wounded and was on the run. And I said, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting scenario, you know.
I remember Channel 9 interviewing somebody by the name of Omar Jamal, who was claiming that he knew the individual and, you know, he used to, you know, argue about the issues, you know, that related to that, which I doubt, you know, that ever happened. You know, this was a young guy, and he said we used to see him in coffee shops. I don't think that ever happened, you know. But, you know, they just need somebody to who is saying whatever they want to say, you know, and they will interview that person. And he's that's all he does, Mr. Omar Jamal, sadly. And he's known for that.
Now, this is Omar Jamal that... unfortunately, there was a piece on him. He's been kind of a spokesperson for quite some time, but come to find out that when he immigrated from Somalia, he immigrated initially to Canada, where he was arrested on some situations, and then somewhere or another he showed up in Louisville, Kentucky, and then he went from Louisville and he showed up here and he kind of became a spokesman. Is this the same Omar Jamal that we're talking about?
Yeah, basically he had this organization called Somali Justice Center or something
right.
like that. Somali mm-hmm. Justice Advocacy. So they didn't like what he was saying when the shooting of Jelani in 2001 in Minneapolis. The Minneapolis police shot the mentally, you know, sick individual.
Yeah, Franklin. Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So, and then that's where shut him off, maybe that's where they came up with this immigration case. And a United States attorney at that time openly said, you know, we are doing this, you know, because we don't like him. Something like that, you know, which
yes,
it doesn't
yes.
even sound, you know, somebody in that position would say to the media. But he's the same individual who was facing. And then after maybe they start deal some kind of deal, I don't know, and then they let him off the hook. And probably
yes, they did.
Him,
I
know
the history. Yeah, he came from Canada to Louisville. He was living in Louisville, Kentucky for a while, and then he kind of was told to go up to the largest community. The last time I know you and I remember that we really heard of Omar was the alleged Islamic bomber who came out of Portland, Oregon. And I remember my good friend Omar was saying that he knew the mother who lived here, but some way or another the young man had relocated to Portland, Oregon. You remember that one?
Yeah, I remember, you know. And,
okay.
They always like to interview him because they like what he says and things like that. And he's also now, I think, he's one of the Somali diplomats in the United Nations office. So, he has also that position, you know, in first secretary of something like
all
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Asafa, anything else for us that you want to share with community and with our international audience?
Yeah, the issue that I was calling in was about the meeting and with the United States Attorney General
Eric Holder. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as I said last time, last Saturday, the meeting I hear about through somebody I know. You know, it wasn't publicized, and then I called in the United States Attorney's Office in Minneapolis, where they told me, you can come, but don't tell anybody else. And
I
questioned why you don't want to share with the people, he said, oh, Somalis, no. And he want to exclusively meet with the Somalis. And I knew, how, and when I asked them how Somalis know, the individual who I was talking to said, oh, we already, the leaders, Somali community leaders know. And I know that those are people like the guy we were talking about, and they will never tell anybody, you know, because they will tell them, you know, just come, show up. And anyway, I went there 2 o'clock, and they had a list, you know, of people who were guests. And My name, you know, they asked me to show ID, my name, miss, you know, my name, because they got my name from my cell phone, and my name is not, it's Mrs. Bradley, on, you know, my cell phone, it showed, you know, Mustafa AMMD, something like that. They let me, inside I found a lot of white folks and few Somalis, the few who they call community leaders, and our congressman was there, the mayor, and the United States Attorney for Minnesota, Mr. Todd Jones. Those two people were running the show, and he briefly, you know, the Attorney General briefly spoke about. Actually, what I would say was a good speech. You know, he talked about how he grew up in inner city, New York, and he understands, you know, how, you know, what kind of difficulties young people face living in, growing up in an inner city and being a black and all things like that. His suggestion was to begin with to talk to the community, you know, have a conversation with them and hear what kind of problems they have. And I thought that was a good idea, and it doesn't happen that much, you know. It was something that very rare. And
well, of course, now the thing that people, you know, I mean, we all saw that story, and we appreciated your comments last Saturday. What people don't seem to understand is that the Somali community has been targeted here in Minneapolis for a long time, ever since 9/11. And it certainly has increased. In fact, there have been a couple of Homeland Security FBI tasks, I think you know as well as I do, Mustafa, that have come in to the Twin Cities. And, you know, in a conversation with someone a year and a half ago, I said, you know, you need to understand that sting operations are being run. And what we mean here on Point by sting operations, people show up. They're usually agent provocateurs. Most of the time, they're military. They may even be Somalis, if you will. And they begin to act as if they're fundamentalists, and they try to recruit young people. And then we have these sensational arrests, and then the news media is fed the information, and folks begin to talk in terms of these terrible communities. And these sting operations have been going on since 2007 here in the Twin Cities, and I've always had a very uneasy feeling as a black American about what's being done to the Somali community with respect to these operations and the fact that your community is clearly being targeted as it pertains to the war on terror.
And manipulated, you know, through those people who they call community leaders, and they empower them and they give them money. All these foundations give them money. There's no accountability. And it reminds me of how Western aid organizations and governments, when they go to Africa and other places that there are some kind of disaster or one way or another, that's how they do. You know, they go to the places like Somalia, and before even they get there, they send somebody there who will sell. Well, like, things like the food and things like that. Even younger Somalis know about it, because it will say USA aid, you know, and there's a sign, two people shaking hands. And when the ship comes to a port, you know, there's a businessman waiting there. And that they do, over there they do openly. And I see here same practice, you know, corrupting people and spreading corruption in the community. And I remember, you know, I still go to the Pine Choir Center every now and then to volunteer. So one day, youngster, about 11 or 12 years old, asked me why I was doing whatever I was doing there to volunteer. And then he said, are the white people giving you money to do this? And then when I said no, he kind of, you know, didn't believe me. But after that, I talked to him, and I found out those who claim to helping people with the school and homework and after the school programs like that. That's all they do, you know, bring some kids together and then every now and then give them a few dollars. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
We saw that at the height of the so-called civil rights movement in Black America in the late 1950s and 60s. Mustafa, I want to thank you for getting back to us. Feel free to give us a call. Update us if you you feel that you can do that with safety and comfort. Okay?
Okay, thank you, and I do
appreciate it. All right, thank you, sir. All right.
Thanks, Mustafa. Okay, Mr. Irwin.
You know, give the number again, Mr. Irwin. I'm interested because we had a very enlightening conversation there with a man who certainly is well-versed about his community and also about the practices. I'm interested to see if anyone's got any observations because we put out a couple of provocative things, sting operations and et cetera, being directed against the Somali/Muslim/Islamic community, really without firm evidence and et cetera. I'm interested to see if anyone has any questions on that.
Yeah, me too. Our number is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. Give us a call. And Mr. Edwards, that piece of news, it actually broke earlier this week. The Republicans are looking to end VA health care for over 1.3 million veterans.
And you're a veteran. You served and were honorably discharged,
yes.
If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Allen.
Yes, that is correct.
That would affect you, wouldn't it?
Well, actually, what they're looking at in here is they're looking at veterans that when you have a when I got out of the service, the Army, I had a bum knee and bum ankles. So I went and had a compensation and pension hearing or checkup and then a hearing with a representative who was my power of attorney at the American Legion out at Fort Snelling. Okay.
Okay.
At that time, they says, okay, where to file your paperwork? Well, when veterans have a some disability or service, in this case, service-connected disability, mm-hmm. the first rating you usually get is a zero, okay?
Okay.
Now, that zero means that, okay, they recognize that you do have a disability, okay? So you could be on your deathbed with that zero rating. What the Republicans are trying to do, elected officials in D.C., Republican officials, is cut out all the zeros, okay? Eliminate the health care for all the zero percentage ratings. So,
so
if this was 8 years ago when they first came back and says, okay, Mr. Allen, we recognize that you were in a Jeep accident in the service, you hurt your knee, your left knee and your ankles, and your mobility is limited to some point, so you can't do construction or climb ladders or anything like that. We're going to make you a Chapter 31 veteran so you can go to school for free, which I greatly appreciate it. Now, mm-hmm. if you're a veteran and you don't keep on top, what happens is when these veterans get this letter in the mail that says you're 0%, which is no compensation, they give up. Okay, they give up right there.
Okay.
What they have to do is they have to go back and reapply, and push the envelope and go back in for another comp and pinch hearing and checkup at the VA hospital. Now, my second one, they rated me 30%. Then they rated me 60, and then they rated me 90, okay? So
okay. It went from 0 to 90.
Yeah,
Must have been a different crew of doctors. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so it took, you know, over an eight-year period just to, you know, to get at a satisfactory rate with the VA that I felt that I could function and do what I needed to do, and as a service, a proud service member in the Army, that this is what to do me for what has happened. And so, but you have let me get back to the Republicans. They're trying to just cut out health care, period. If you have a zero compensation or disability, if you come back a zero, there are millions of veterans in the United States that have a 0% disability rating. And to eliminate health care for them now, especially the youngsters coming out of Iraq, Afghanistan, all across the country, PTSD. The veterans have some of the highest rates of alcoholism, domestic violence. Let me just go down here. And it affects veterans of color, Mr. Edwards, doubly hard. There's roughly 56% of all homeless veterans in America are African American and Hispanic.
Oh, we don't, you know, we don't like to talk about that, do we?
56%, yeah, no, we don't.
Let's repeat that again for our listening audience. 56% of homeless veterans in America are African Americans. Isn't that fascinating?
African American and Hispanic, but despite only accounting for 12.8% and 15.4% respectively of the U.S. population, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
About 1.5 other million other veterans, meanwhile, are considered at risk of homelessness due to poverty, lack of networks, and dismal living conditions in overcrowded or substandard housing. So you have all these zero percenters and all these veterans out there that need help, be it physical, mental, whatever, and they're actually not getting it. Part of this is, you know, it's a big bureaucracy. I'm not knocking the people at the VA. They've always done great things for me and at Fort Snelling. I mean, but you have to do the work. And there's so many guys falling through the crack. I remember a story about 3 or 4 years back of a veteran going in saying that he's depressed, he's hopeless, and they let him go. Okay, he ended up committing suicide. And
there are many, unfortunately, many cases. In other roles that I'm involved in, I work with people.
Hold on,
caller. We have a caller?
Yes, we do, Mr. Edwards, actually.
Let's get him.
You're live on Point. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Don. This is Lisa calling in.
Hey, Lisa. How you doing?
I'm well.
Let's let her know she's on the air. She's on the air.
You're live on the air now with me and Mr. Edwards.
Well, I wanted to know, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, well, I'm calling. I have been listening to the show as far as about the tornado relief.
Yes.
And I wanted to say that I have been to a lot of those meetings where our meetings taking place to focus on the human needs and the some of the other needs such as like shelter and things like that. And in the meetings, one thing that we understand is that there are so many people out there that's working on these efforts that we need to really take into consideration the time that it's going to take to get things done, to make sure that we're all on the same track or that we all know what each other is doing. One thing, there are some questions that you had on the show about the volunteers. It was discussed that the volunteers, we're not sure, whoever is organizing the volunteers, that organization will be reimbursed 25%. They have recorded the number of volunteers. So if volunteers are being paid, then that may be coming from the organization that they are working for, but we don't know that. So I understand that they're just going to get the 25% reimbursement. The thing about the bridge, because I know in the meeting I did mention that employment is very important, so we do have a transparency committee that I am on to make sure that we focus on making sure that, excuse my language, the poverty pimps do not kind of like get involved and whatever. We just don't want that in the group. So we do have overseers that is kind of paying attention. We know that our main focus is the people, and it's not our egos. This is not about us. So one thing about the bridge, to my understanding, the FEMA money is going towards the infrastructure. It's not going to the people. It's going towards the rebuilding of the north side, and we want to make sure that we know how that looks. So that pitch is not out there yet. But with that bridge, I think that that bridge is important because it connects the north side to the northeast and everything like that. So when we look at jobs, we do want that bridge up. So I don't know. As far as me, I think it's a good idea if we could use some of that money to rebuild that bridge, that Laurie Avenue bridge, to get some people to be able to commute.
We're not talking about the Laurie. We're talking about both the Laurie and the Plymouth Avenue bridge also, Lisa.
Okay, I'm not aware of the Plymouth Avenue bridge, but I do know that Laurie bridge is something that that should be rebuilt. But I just want to
say, let me ask you a question. Tell our listening audience, what is a navigator? You and I had a chance to hear that Was that the first time in that you've been in so many of the subcommittee meetings? What is a navigator, and could you share that with me? What does a navigator do?
Well, we are, one thing that we have discussed, the role of a navigator is to go out door-to-door to get an assessment of what's going on in the community. The needs are making sure that we know what the city is doing as far as when they go door knocking, because they do have plans on going out Monday and Tuesday, so do the door knocking. So we want to make sure the navigators are able to communicate with those who are going out and gathering all that data. So as far as one of the groups that we're on, the tornado recovery, the long-term recovery, we're going to have our navigators to look into that. We're still working on the role of the navigator specifically, but we know starting now it's going to be an assessment of the needs of the people on the north side.
Now, let me ask you this question. How long has the position of navigator been in play? Has anyone shared that with you? I mean, when was that position first created, and do you know the agencies that have navigators in them?
Well, one thing that was discussed in the meeting today, one of the committees, well, actually, not yesterday, this was discussed last week in one of the long-term recovery groups that has been put together. We're still working on getting those navigators, but the other navigators, working with Shiloh Temple, I believe, the Kiwanza Community Church, and this was discussed yesterday, that there are navigators out there, but we are not aware. What was told was that for them to bring exactly what the navigators that are part of that group, what they're doing, bring that to our attention in the human needs group, so that we can support them. That is one thing that we did mention.
Okay, all right then. Mr. Allen, we got anything else?
No, that's all I had. Hey, Lisa, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Lisa.
All right.
Really appreciate it. We'll talk.
All right. Let me just explain particularly to our domestic international audience, navigator, because yesterday was the first time that I've heard a official declaration confirming the existence of these individuals, navigators. Mr. Allen, had you ever heard about that before?
I've heard a little bit about it, not in those roundtable meetings, but I knew some agencies that actually do a good job at it over north. So,
okay, because we had I had to ask the question yesterday, but I asked the question after hearing much discussion if there was a navigator or a person who was designated as a navigator. And what happened was a man by the name of Jerry Moore turned out to be a navigator. Mm-hmm. And we kind of got into some reflections about it. Appears that, and she's correct, appears that Kwanzaa Church, it appears that Pillsbury United, and maybe a couple others have anywhere from one to three, quote-unquote, navigators in the facility. Now, really, a navigator is just like a community organizer, really, but I guess it's the new definition. But it would probably be good to get the list of who the navigators are and who the agencies are that have navigators, because the navigator is really supposed to go out and do the boots on the ground.
Okay, we have another call, Mr. Edwards.
Oh, let's get them.
You're live on On Point. Lisa? Oh, she probably called in to listen. Let me put her back on hold here. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Edwards. I'm sorry.
No. So I'm just trying to make sure that our listening audiences, transparency is important, that these positions and these individuals who are identified as navigators, they will be going out. Now, I don't know if they've been going out with city and state and FEMA teams, you know what I'm saying, and helping with the information, because navigators are supposed to know how to navigate the community, Don.
Yes.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes,
that's
sir.
Where the genesis comes from, navigating the community, knowing the contacts to be made, knowing key community principles, if you will, and et cetera, everyone from the head of an agency to the guy that has the local grocery store, you know what I'm saying, the manager of the local CVS or Walgreens or et cetera, or just the local mechanic in the backyard. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
That is supposed to be the role of the navigator. Now, in the old days, when we were at the University of Syracuse, navigator was a community organizer. But I just wanted to kind of get that out because I'm interested to know how that's working and how much information the navigators were able to feed in to the matrix. Because as we said at the top of this program this afternoon, one of the things that's disturbing to me, I can't speak for anybody else, but that's disturbing to me, particularly as you pointed out and I pointed out that we just got through with a census, that so many numbers are absent, you know, number of dwellings, number of people still homeless, number of people looking for assistance. Then we go to the job situation, you know, number of people who are certified, if you will, to do the work, to meet the requirements, particularly with this federal money coming in, because the feds, as you and I know, going back to a banquet we attended last November, the feds are real funny about how their money is spent in relationship to statutes and laws, right?
Yes.
And, you know, this was a bad thing that happened earlier this week, investigative report by the Star Tribune, talking in terms of individuals who were ineligible to have been on the list that were served up to people who then got, you know, taken to the cleaners, if you will. And so I began to realize yesterday that this should have been something that our navigators could have been on top of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So
I agree.
Hopefully we'll get a little bit more information, maybe from the mayor and his staff, if he's able to be in attendance. I repeat that again. The mayor will be meeting with the Northside Recovery team on Monday at 2 o'clock at the OIC there on Olson Highway. And maybe the city officials can give us a little bit more fixed. You know, one of the numbers I would certainly ask about, Mr. Allen, over the next 48 hours is how many people were evicted officially today and tomorrow.
Yeah, that would be an interesting number to find out. Very interesting.
Yeah. And what was the racial breakdown, if you will? You know, I mean, I think those are important to transparency, you know what I'm saying? And I think it'd be good to know those numbers if you would. What else do we have? Anything else as we move towards, what, the last 11, 12 minutes?
We have about 8 minutes left here, and I'm just looking at some of the things online that's coming up. But we have, you know, like you said, their mayor will be meeting at 2 o'clock at Summit Academy OIC with their relief effort, and we'd like to invite people to come on out and ask some questions under the our listening audience here locally. And also, Mr. Edwards, one thing that we have to talk about, you know, preferably when the mayor's there, because I hope he brings Ms. Velma Corbell and Johnny Burns in, is that we're going to have to talk about that list and how that list was generated, knowing that, you know, we have the origin, and I'm actually going to release that in a story in the next couple of days, but we want to know how that process worked, and I just want to hear it out of the mayor's mouth. You know?
So. Well, absolutely, and see what the mayor's thinking is. Another item that is important for our international, but particularly our domestic audience, because apparently a lot of states are getting ready to be hit with it. Story front page metro section here in our city, in our newspaper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune. 40,000 layoff notices went out to state employees yesterday, Don.
Wow.
40,000. And what's happening right now, the Dayton administration, that's our governor, Governor Mark Dayton, are meeting behind closed doors. We've got about 6 minutes left on this one.
Yeah.
They're meeting behind closed doors looking at the contingency plan, what and who's going to be able to work. They're beginning to talk in terms of being dependent upon the court, something that happened for a very, very, very brief period of time in 2005 when there was a temporary shutdown of government under Tim Pawlenty. Tim Pawlenty, who was a candidate for president.
Yeah.
But what happened is that they really got to decide who's going to be able to operate, who's not. One of the things that came up, and certainly our friends at Springboard, I hope, talked about that this morning. Basically, all of the major construction public works projects will have to be shut down.
Yes.
Starting with light rail. But also, here's what this means. And this is a question we leave with our audience, Mr. Allen. Based on the fact that city government, excuse me, well, actually, if state government shuts down, county and municipalities go right with it, you know, primarily. What will a shutdown of state government mean to the recovery effort in North Minneapolis?
Yes. That's
okay.
A big piece. That's a big piece.
And I asked that question, and we've already been in consultation asking our National Research Institute in, to do some research on this to give us some numbers as we move into the meeting with the mayor and next week. But I think it's a valid concern that really needs to be analyzed, because if we're promising all these jobs for all these people of color, we need to know what that means, because we'll be right in the heat of the summer, if you know what I mean. School's out, school closed basically for the summer in our school districts. And so we have a lot of young people out there, but more importantly, we have a lot of older people who've been unemployed for a long time. And then with those services closed down, I mean, everything from mass transit to being able to get service with respect to your needs. You know, we have a committee, which Lisa just talked about, talking about, is it human needs consideration? Yeah, well, I wonder how we're going to be affected by that. And, you know, should we not be working on an emergency plan within the Northside Recovery Team? Don, what's your thinking?
I think there should be some kind of plan within Northside Recovery Team, but, you know, they're not talking about that. Again, Mr. Edwards, with approximately, let me see, I think 4 minutes left here, we said this time and time again, North Minneapolis, especially the black, more importantly, the black community, does not have a government entity. Well, we're supposed to have a council on black Minnesotans that will address this, that does the forward planning.
Have been to a single meeting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so with that said, it's going to be tough. It's going to be real tough to figure out, you know, if the government shuts down, what does that mean for people, you know?
Now, let me say this to you, Mr. Allen, and for those that well, certainly in the chat rooms and et cetera, and those that, you know, refer to the Heckle and Jide, Jekyll and Hyde, you know, really, it shouldn't have been us as black bloggers raising this late into the equation here on Point.
Yeah.
That should have been raised a number of weeks ago. And not by us, but by the people who the system expects able to think through and monitor of that process. You understand where I'm coming from?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, we've been very patient, but we've reached the point with the formal notifications. 40,000 layoff notices went out yesterday to state workers. It shouldn't have been us here at Black Blog Radio. It should have been those who say that they are the giants, if you will, and the great thinkers. I mean, you know, I just feel that very strongly. You know what I'm saying? Maybe next Saturday, maybe we can have a little bit more detail, information on what a possible shutdown will mean to our community and, more importantly, Mr. Allen, the recovery of North Minneapolis.
Yeah, I agree. Well, with right under 2 minutes left here, Mr. Edwards, I'd like to invite everybody to listen to Blog Talk Radio tomorrow to your show, your 30-minute program, Black Focus 2. And what is the topic?
We basically will be talking about the recovery effort, and we will be highlighting the question of what will a government shutdown mean for the recovery in North Minneapolis.
Okay, and then if you live in Minneapolis proper and get Minneapolis Television Network through Comcast, tune in to Channel 17 at 5 p.m. for Black Focus. And, Mr. Edwards, your topic on that television show?
We'll be talking about the recovery and what is taking place. And we will be talking about how a projection of 166 million dropped to 16.9 and what really was at
play. I cannot look at this guy without laughing.
Sorry. Okay.
Take care.
Yeah. And thanks for listening to On Point today. And don't forget to read the Independent Business News Network. Have a great day.